This week we discussed the gerrymander wars, military in the cities and freedom zones, and Seward's folly, Trump meets Putin in Alaska on Friday. Good evening. You're either watching or listening to Redwood Walk. My name is Eric Kirk.
And I'm David Frank.
And we are discussing national political news of the day. And we're going to start with a story that is kind of happening a lot in California, because Governor Newsom is at the kind of the center of it. And that is the gerrymander wars. We've been discussing this in recent weeks. I pretty much blame the Supreme Court for this, by the way. I mean, Trump is basically wants to get five more districts to preserve the House majority in 2026. So Newsom has pledged to match that in California. And now other states are getting into the act. In fact, New York legislators have just introduced measures for constitutional amendments to a constitutional amendment to be able to do midterm there. We are going to have, it sounds like, a constitutional a ballot initiative for this November for the voters to decide if we are going to overturn our previous ballot initiative to at least temporarily allow us to, here mid-decade, redo ours to counter the Texas theme. Illinois is making moves. Florida is making moves. Ohio, Indiana, they can only do one vote there. And Missouri, the same thing there. I don't know what Florida can do. I think they're pretty well tapped out. I think they've really, I mean, maybe a little bit more. They can get one or two more, but they've already gerrymandered that to the hilt. I mean, a lot of the states have already done it. I mean, Texas already gerrymandered it. They've still, and by the way, it's one thing when they do the gerrymanders, they've still got to win the elections. These are things that you have. There's no guarantees of these. When you're gerrymandering, you are basically remixing things, and that means you take away votes in one party from one district and you add them to another. And it may be that voters in both parties get a little tired of this, and independents get tired of this too. So they may backlash against one or both parties. We don't know what's going to happen here. Maybe some independent candidates will come in and say they don't like any of this. But the point is that, as we've discussed on this show, before people start saying a pox on both houses, the fact of the matter is there are a total of 21 states that have gerrymandered for partisan reasons. Traditionally, there's been a lot of gerrymandering by incumbents. It's been bipartisan for incumbents to stay in office. But since Tom the Hammer DeLay got involved with the Republicans about 20 years ago, 18 states have gerrymandered in favor of Republicans. Three have gerrymandered in favor of Democrats, Maryland, the worst for Democrats, but there are just ridiculous ones for the Republicans, and we've discussed them in great detail. But now California is going to join that, and it could lead to the split up of the 707 district that we all love, but it probably will be a temporary measure. We might regain it later. I mean, hopefully it'll all blow over. Maybe the Supreme Court will actually step in and do something. And I'll come back to the Supreme Court later. But Dave, what have you got to say about this?
Well, there's a few interesting things here. Feels good to be back, first of all, and diving into gerrymandering. I know this is a subject that's near and dear to your heart. We tracked congressional districts prior to the last couple of elections, and it's kind of a big deal, the balance of power in the House right now leading into 2026, because it looks like the Senate, the GOP will retain control of the Senate, all things being equal. So the House is really, that's the critical
A couple developments point there between Cooper in North Carolina and Sherrod Brown in Ohio. Nothing's guaranteed there, but they probably still will hold on to it. But those are good developments for the Democrats. But we can talk about that
most definitely. Yeah. Realistically, like high level, when people ask me about this, like, you know, in social circles, I always start out by saying that I really respect the system California has in place. Okay. The commission that sets up these districts here in California really is, as we've talked about in prior shows, it's designed around communities. What's the phrase?
Communities of interest.
Communities of interest. Exactly. I knew you would know. It's actually an admirable system where you're not the legislature doesn't have politics and carving out their own voter base in mind. It's an independent commission. And really, the districts are geographically justifiable. But also, like we said, the communities of interest. So I think it's interesting that California is like being thrown into this in the heat of the moment, that, you know, basically the word on the street, you know, people have said that Donald Trump directly contacted Governor Abbott in Texas and said, do what you can do with your legislature to get me more seats. We need to do this. And that, in fact, there's a little bit of a kerfuffle, I guess you could call it, in Texas, where the attorney general actually said, no, actually, this is something that I need to initiate. And then they put into the law. He filed paperwork with the court system in Texas to say, let me do this, not the governor. In part, I think it's because he's running for Senate. So he's just looking, you know, that's just a minor observation there. He really wants to have his name be front and center in this whole process as being, you know, Team Trump as somebody who's getting things done. So that's like inside baseball a little bit about, is our system currently in California admirable? Definitely. Should we change it? Under most circumstances, I would say most people would agree no.
If you have any questions or comments, email us at redwoodwonk@gmail.com.
You can listen to Rub and Wonk on KZZH 96.7 FM every Tuesday and Thursday night at 8 p.m.
But like you mentioned, Texas isn't alone. There's also Ohio, as you said, where the GOP holds 13 of 18 seats. And they're looking to pick up three. Florida, the GOP holds 20 of 28 seats. And DeSantis has said he would try to get a special session put in place to try to carve out a little bit more seats there. But who knows how many they'd be successful with. And then Indiana and Missouri both are looking to pick up one or two seats. So in light of that, and there's also other conversations out there, like on Steve Bannon's show. I forgot who he was talking to about it. But they were talking about picking up 40 seats. So I don't even know what they're thinking. But the idea is that this is a battleground that needs to be contested. And here in California, there's been steps already taken. So the legislature isn't really speaking about it publicly that much. But the truth is that here we are, it's 43 out of 52 seats. And Governor Newsom has said he expects that the Democratic new map would add five to combat the Texas, as you mentioned. So they haven't released that map. But again, what this would require a referendum, and they have only 4 days after August 18th to get something on the ballot after their summer break. That's when they come back from summer break. But the truth is that the California legislature has exempted itself from deadlines in the past, and they have really come out in favor. And I'll just say we can get more into the details, but Assembly Speaker Rivas said that they're strongly in favor. We will fight fire with fire. The Speaker Pro Tem President Pro Tem of the Senate, he didn't say anything publicly, but people have leaked out that it's a go in the Senate. So it's probably going to get on the ballot, but it might not actually win. So we could talk more about that.
That's the thing. It has to pass. Unlike all of the other states, it's going to have to go to voters, which makes it less undemocratic than other states in that sense. There has been one holdout, one Democrat, who was saying, well, this will just trigger, you know, real bad, you know, going down the rabbit hole gerrymandering. But I think they had a conversation with them and said, we're already down there. I mean, 18 Republican states have done it. It's bat guano goofy.
Yeah. So I would just add the Democratic side, like you mentioned, there are other states besides California that are looking to do it. New York has mentioned that they would have to put in place a special one-time change where Democrats hold 19 of 26 seats. But I looked into it a little bit. It doesn't seem like they're going to be able to do it on time. Yeah. So New York is really just sort of in solidarity with California. And similarly in Illinois, Governor Pritzker has come out in favor. They have 14 of 17 seats there. It's not clear that they can pick up any or many, that there would be much of an added benefit. Because
they've already gerrymandered. They're one of the three Democratic states that have gerrymandered. So,
Eric, as a lawyer, I think I would like to bounce this off you. So the precedent is there, right? Article 1, Section 2, the House seats shall be apportioned according to an enumeration of persons within 3 years of the first congressional session and within every subsequent term of 10 years. But that people haven't stuck to that. So this is all really legal. California did it once back in the 80s, 1980s. Supreme Court even said in 2019 that they would not prevent the denial of representation to minority groups. They won't block it purely for partisan redistricting.
Right. As long as you word it saying, hey, we just want political power. We don't have anything against black people. Right.
Right.
As long as they do that, except when it's so blatant, like Alabama, when there's, you know, such a history and when it's really almost entirely black people that are being marginalized. It had to be that extreme. There's a lawsuit pending in New Orleans, in Louisiana that might replicate that decision. But again, by allowing that to happen, by saying you can discriminate according to race as long as your motive is political, that's what opened this up. This would not happen. Texas could not do this. What it wants to do, California could probably pull it off, but Texas could not. Do this without violating the Voting Rights Act. Ohio maybe could do it, but possibly New York. But Texas could not do it. They're going to have to break up minority districts. There's no other way for them to do it. You know, and they've got the snake one. You know, the entrance. You know, that goes from Austin to Houston, I think it is. I can't remember, but it just, you know, from suburb to suburb. I mean, in Utah, they can do. As we've shown, you've got the four districts that have big, massive rural areas with tendrils that extend into Salt Lake City, because even though Salt Lake City is more progressive, it's still mostly white, so it didn't violate the Voting Rights Act. But California, we have a good system, a commission of five Democrats, five Republicans, and four independents that put together, and it still benefited Democrats because geography basically doesn't guarantee that you're going to have an equal distribution of Democrats and Republicans. That, of course, has led Republicans to say they're gerrymandering somehow because Trump got 38% of the vote and somehow they've only got, you know, under 20% of the seats. It just doesn't work out that way. First of all, not everybody who votes for Trump necessarily votes for the the Republican candidate for Congress. And second of all, a lot of them don't even vote down ticket, you know, so there's a lot of issues there. New York, they might not be able to do it unless they do something similar here and basically, while they're putting it on, get rid of the time limitations. I don't know what those possibilities are. I don't know if they're looking at other states to do it. New Jersey is looking at it, but they've got time limits too. There's not very many other big Democratic states that can do it. You know, there are states that neither party has total control over, like Pennsylvania and others, you know, that they can only do so much. Wisconsin is actually is purple, but it's already been gerrymandered to benefit Republicans. Extreme. You know, so it's just but this is just absolutely, it's gotten to absolute ridiculous levels. And the Supreme Court has created this mess. Based on what I consider being absolutely ridiculous ruling, because discrimination is discrimination, regardless of what your motivation is. It doesn't have to be motivated by racial hatred. That was just an absolutely ridiculous ruling, one among many.
I know we've been churning this a little bit, and so we've talked about the what and the how, but then the question is, like, you know, will it, right? So to a certain extent, not that we're making a prediction here, but, you know, Cal Matters, I think, was covering, that's where I got the sort of behind the scenes scoop about what's going on in the Assembly and the Senate right now in California. Are they going to do it? And there's a lot of energy around, well, we should do it if Texas goes ahead with what they're doing. Sure. But you can't really wait, obviously, under the circumstances, as we just described. They only have 4 days to get on the ballot. You've got people like Beto O'Rourke, who ran for Senate there in Texas. He's out there saying, look, any state that can do it must do it. Yeah. And, you know, there are no rules anymore. Look at the nature of this administration. Just push full steam ahead. You know, basically, like, fight fire with fire.
It's tricky because, you know, the Democrats in Texas, a bunch of them left, so they don't have the quorum. Some of them are here in California right now. My understanding is they may have blown their timeline. So Texas that started this may not be able to do it, but they might try to get around that timeline. And so what I think could happen there is that the Democrats say, look, let's just get this thing on the ballot. We can always just say, hey, and encourage our voters to not vote for it in the long run. We can say we put this on the ballot because we thought this was going to happen. Now that it's not going to happen, we encourage them we encourage you to vote it down. But we've shown that we could do this in the future, and maybe that'll deter it in the future. You know, there's a lot of ways they can do this and make it kind of interesting. Governor Newsom has been showing to be, you know, one of the Democrats that will put up a fight. I mean, you were in Florida when, you know, Miller was threatening to arrest him, and Newsom said, hey, come on, tough guy, bring it on, you know, and all of a sudden Miller said, I didn't say that. I didn't say he was, you know, and it was just, I mean, he has been, you know, the person to do this. He's clearly running for president. And he wants to show that he will put up a fight. And so he would probably get on if Texas doesn't do it and the other Republican states don't do it. He'll probably get up there and say, look, we had to get this on the ballot, but let's not vote for this. But we don't need to do this. We want, we'd like our system here. We only did this because because it was an emergency. It looked like, you know, things were going bad, but the Democrats in Texas managed to thwart this. So let's not do what we don't have to do, but let's be ready to do it again if they try to pull it. I mean, I think they can do that.
Yeah, last 2 points. I know we've been talking about this for a while. One is that they did some poll testing around what the ballot might look like to just put a finger to the wind, see how popular it is out there. They ended up saying basically, we're going to retain the commission. We support fair nonpartisan commissions nationwide. We want to adopt congressional districts passed by the legislature for use in congressional elections through 2030. So 26, 28, 30, and we're going to retain California's original district maps if Texas or other states also retain their original district maps. So they tried to hit all the key points, floated that out there. It was only 52% yes, 41% no, 7% undecided, which means there's going to be a lot of money thrown into that ballot initiative. Yeah. Former Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger already said he's going to speak out against it.
Sure.
The person who actually, Charles Munger Jr., who is credited with bankrolling the ballot measures that created those commissions, he said he would support an opposition campaign. So it won't be easy to pass.
No,
and then finally, the last thing I would say, obviously Trump and Republicans, they expect that they would be spending a lot of money on this. But the truth is they could also bog it down in the courts. So the election is November 2026. They've got a few different areas where they can sue. For example, do you use the census data or do you use the Department of Finance demographic unit data? Did you disenfranchise a protected ethnic group? And so Trump's Department of Justice could conceivably be a thorn in the side of the ability to get that passed in a timely way.
Yeah. But all the while, the Democrats will make hay on the hypocrisy of it. You know, they'll just sit there and say, look, we've got laws here in California that they can use, and there aren't similar laws in Texas. How fair is that? I mean, they'll use that and hammer on it day after day, and they'll just say, and a lot of it will, that 52%, that's a starting point. I'm amazed it's that high. I figured it would start underwater, and then the more this happens in other states, more would build support. If that's the starting point, I think by the time it comes around, it'll pass overwhelmingly if it happens in Texas and anywhere else. But we should move on, and we'll have plenty of time to talk about this. If you have any questions or comments, email us at redwoodwonk@gmail.com.
Listen to Rub and Wonk on KZZH 96.7 FM every Tuesday and Thursday night at 8 p.m.
So we come back to the discussion of authoritarianism, which is an ongoing theme because it's an ongoing reality. As we move, we've had the militarization of Los Angeles for riots that are, quite frankly, wimpy compared to riots of the past in this country, certainly compared to Watts. And they not only have the National Guard have been brought in, but the Marines, and what for? And there has been speculation that Trump has actually been trying to provoke a Kent State type thing, and really wants the justification to crack down. I mean, there have been some, incidents down there, but nothing, not even like 2020, really, and nothing like January 6th. I mean, really, it's just that bad. So now he's using the crime in Washington, D.C., particularly the mugging of Big Balls, Doge guy, evidence that Washington, D.C. has become a criminal dystopia. I think the Democrats have to be careful here because, one of the reasons Harris lost was there was the paper economy versus what people are feeling. And the fact of the matter is crime has been dropping over the past couple of years. Actually, crime has been dropping over the past few decades with, a few blips here and there. But crime has been dropping in D.C., in San Francisco dramatically, actually, and other places. But Trump is basically militarizing and sending federal troops and other entities walking neighborhoods. It's been kind of strange, actually. I mean, there's a viral video of a guy, African-American guy, smoking a cigarette on his stairs being harassed by a group of people in fatigue saying, well, that smells kind of like marijuana. And he's like, well, you obviously don't know what marijuana smells like. I mean, it's a cigarette. Yes. Well, it's 2 a.m. Like, okay, I have the right to be out here 2 a.m. I mean, it's just, I don't have to explain myself. I work late, but I don't have to explain myself. I mean, this is what's going on. And then he's talking about other cities, Oakland, all the cities Trump is named, by the way, a black mayor, is just pointing that out. But there have been discussions of militarizing the police. Now, ICE is going a long ways towards that. As we've discussed, they're going from $3.5 billion in funding to almost $50 billion, larger than the Russian military. They are
over 100. It's over 100.
Oh, it's over 100. Okay. I guess that was just the big, beautiful bill. I guess other stuff has been passing. So they're recruiting. They've got, former Lois and Clark Superman has joined them. Everybody, they have no age limit. Everybody is joining. This is going to become a militarized domestic police force. So they want to use them for something. And he wants, and we have these concepts that Peter Thiel and other CEOs have come up with of these privatized freedom zones of companies running cities in what can only be described as an authoritarian manner. It brings back we're reminiscent of the 1970s dystopian movie Rollerball. There was no longer a nation state. Each city was owned by a corporation, and you had this game that distracted the proletariat or whatever. But it was just we know this is on their agenda, whether or not they can realistically achieve it over the there's going to be a lot of pushback, but it's happening. And it's happening in Washington, D.C. That is federal jurisdiction, so it's going to be a bit easier. And finally, the mayor of Washington, D.C. is pushing back. She kind of was not for a while there, but she finally pushed back today saying, wait a minute, this is a bit much. So what are we in it for, Dave?
Well, I mean, you had asked when you framed this up, Is this an authoritarian move, or is it really an innovative solution to crime? And because that's the way some people are seeing it, right? Some people hear that crime is terrible in the cities. Because President Trump was out there saying that it's a threat. The situation on the ground in D.C. is a threat to the functioning of the federal government in D.C. He called it a threat to America. Yeah. And he said other cities are equally chaotic and marred by all sorts of terrible things that he rattled off. And he named Chicago, L.A., New York, Baltimore, Oakland. He said, we're going to clean up D.C. very quickly, and then we're going to take a look at other cities. So this is almost like a proof of concept or like a pilot for them to kind of go in and see what they identify as crime.
Yes.
And so I think it's pretty telling that today there were videos circulating of city employees putting, basically eviction notices on tents in parks across the city saying that, today is the 13th of August, Wednesday, and you have until 10 a.m. on Thursday, August 14th. And after that, everything's going in the garbage. And you can't be here. You'll be trespassing. Yeah. So no matter what your political inclination is, that's never been considered a viable solution to people to the homeless problem in the parks of D.C. No one ever said if you just throw away everybody's stuff and kick them out that's going to solve the problem. But if you vilify these people and say that they're a threat to businesses and security and safety. These very same people that are basically sleeping in a tent and, hanging out in the park with almost impaired economic resources, that somehow they are also committing crimes. So I think that the criminals that they did arrest so far was some gang activity. And that's really just that should be the activity of the Metropolitan Police. So I'd mention this, that just so everybody knows that it's the Home Rule Act. It's Section 740, and it allows the federal government, because they are the basically sovereign over D.C. The U.S. legislature is sovereign over the D.C. is not a state, and they're allowed to federalize the Metropolitan D.C. Police for up to 30 days under conditions. It has to be an emergency. You have to be limited to in duration, and it has to be for a stated federal purpose. So I think Trump's team went out there and said, look, we can't run the government because it's a threat to the safety of every federal worker in the entire D.C. I think that was what his claim was. And that it's an emergency now because who knows why now as opposed to any other time. But that limited duration part, they've already floated that they're going to plan on extending this beyond 30 days and that they're claiming they won't need congressional approval. And the truth is they could probably get congressional approval in control of both houses if they wanted to. But more importantly, I think is, you know, not to say DC is not important, but
it's not a filibuster proof thing. I don't know. It would depend on the Democrats.
Oh, true enough. Yeah, true enough. So he probably is just laying out the gauntlet that like he could just do it. But Secretary of Defense Hegseth said the president has instructed him to work with other states to federalize the National Guards for the cities in their states. So they're lining up to like the memorandum of understanding relationships in the states where they're able to ahead of time. And the backlash is obviously pretty biting. That look, if you look at the uniform crime reporting statistics for DC, serious violent crimes are at a 30-year low.
Yes.
And so, you know, obviously the statistics have never been really the discerning, discriminating factor for why things are getting done in the last 6 months of this administration. But a lot of people are speaking out. Like, for example, the mayor did say this is disturbing but not surprising. And this is an example of why DC should become a state so that they're not subjected to this arbitrary encroachment of federal power. I think that's a pretty good case to make. Also, people, and then I'll hand it over to you, but there's an advocacy group called Free DC, and they were saying if you wanted safety and security and stability here in the district, you shouldn't have cut so many jobs and you shouldn't have teams of ICE people driving around, scooping people up and throwing them in vans. And you shouldn't have cut funding to critical medical care and food assistance programs because hungry people don't starve, they steal. So it's just sort of common sense that that this was really a blatant pretext for mobilization. That's what a lot of like Monica Hopkins from the ACLU of DC, that's what she said. Realistically, it's a disregard for the democratic process. And you know, I don't think that there's much you could say other than it's by design. It's an extension of federal power that's really mostly unwarranted.
I've been using this language because I get questions, you know, and of course, there is always a lot of hysteria out there, a lot of dramatic claims, conspiracy theories, whatnot. But the authoritarianism is not a conspiracy theory. It's not a conspiracy. It's a process. If authoritarianism comes to a country, it's because of an overall process, a breakdown of institutions of stability and of a press of, you know, we've talked about all of the elements of it. And people have kind of asked me, and I've been talking about it on different radio shows that I do and the rest. And they, again, they say, the question is, do you think democracy is going to die in this country? Or more specifically, do you think authoritarian rule is going to basically overcome the checks and balances in this country? And you know, first of all, I say there's never a 0% chance. I mean, there's that line in Oppenheimer based on, you know, the fact that that when even on the eve of the Trinity experiment, they could not completely exclude the possibility of that they were going to incinerate the whole atmosphere, create a chain reaction that couldn't stop, that didn't stop. And General Groves, played by Matt Damon in the movie, says, what do you mean almost zero? He says, that is almost zero. A little negligence. Says, what do you want from theory? Oppenheimer says, and General Groves says, zero would be nice. You know, well, yeah. You know, I can never guarantee zero, even in the best of times, because authoritarianism can come in any country, no matter how old and established a democracy, no matter how strong the traditions, because if a significant portion of the population does not value democracy, it's hard to maintain if there is a strong authoritarian push. So when I asked, I would say, I think that democracy will survive this. I do believe that there will be that the institutional checks and balances will hold. I don't know that. I can't guarantee that. I'm not going to give percentages, but I would say the possibilities of it failing are over 1%. I would say not over 2 or 3%. You know, I mean, it's there. I mean, people, you know, bet roulette on those, you know, on those stakes. I'm not comfortable with those stakes because it can happen. And you've got all the elements of it, you know, a strong nationalist movement, scapegoats of entire swaths of the population, including, but not limited to immigrants, militarism, the push behind a single charismatic figure, where all the other aspects of government are seen as being under suspect. It's a possibility. And it's even more of a, but one of the things that has been held, and one of the reasons it didn't work in 2020, despite Max Eastman's really lame plan, is he didn't have support in the military. Right. And he didn't have enough support in the Department of Justice. Well, he's probably going to have the support in the Department of Justice. The question is, will he have support in the military? Well, you know, he doesn't have the military. If he doesn't, can he create his own military? And if he's got military people in all of the major cities, is it going to happen? No, I don't think so. I think that there are plenty of constitutionalists, regardless of what their politics are, in the military. I think there would be a lot of resistance, but can I guarantee it? You know, Trump isn't okay. He isn't the brainiest person in the world, or he wouldn't have followed. He would have gotten somebody better than Eastman, right? But I don't know. You know, he could get lucky. I mean, things can happen. Do I have any doubt that Trump, if he could go over the authoritarian? That's what scares me, is I think he would if he could. But he's not the only one. We've had other people in both parties who would if they could. The way authoritarianism works is people don't necessarily start out that way. They become that way, right? Power corrupts, absolutely. So yes, if we have a large military and we have a paramilitary force that like ICE coming in, that's people that are not disciplined, by the way, are not going to be well trained. I just don't know what's going to happen. I cannot guarantee that. I think it will hold because we are not like, you know, it's not like Germany where it was a young democracy with lack of traditions and some, you know, quirks in the system that could allow a chancellor to have total power if the, you know, when things like this happen. We don't have we have some safeguards against it, but we have a Congress that's completely capitulated. I mean, just they're completely in its own role. We have a Supreme Court that has almost capitulated. I mean, they've stood up and do a few things. Basically, institutionally, we've got the district courts and some of the circuit courts holding on. But they're being called rogue justice judges, even Trump and Bush appointees, some of them, because they're making the wrong decisions. And then we've got the media, but we've got the media caving. We've got academia caving. We've got law firms, large law firms caving. I mean, you know, it's scary. It's when people start caving, when Paramount, settles a suit that it could not possibly have lost. There was no way that a court would ever find that they could tell 60 Minutes how they should conduct an interview. There's no way that they could have lost that one. No way, anyhow. But they paid $15 million because they wanted their merger, and they were afraid that an authoritarian was going to use his power to interfere with the merger. So this is just where I'm at. And you have these agendas of these private cities, the freedom cities with the homes that they might be creating out of this, and who's going to be the police of those. It's concerning. We need to be aware of it. I don't think it's going to happen, but it will happen if we're not vigilant and opposing it. I'll let you close out for the next few minutes, Dave. Sorry, I filibustered there.
No, no problem at all. I mean, I think we covered this pretty thoroughly, and you're passionate about it, so I'm glad you went for it. The last thing I would say here just is that You know, one of the things I heard Trump say, I don't know what day he said this on, but I heard the quote today. He was basically saying that people, when they're confronted by law enforcement, they love to scream and spit in the face of law enforcement. So we want all law enforcement to know, we instruct you to tell anybody who's in your face that when you spit, we hit. So there's a degree of, pleasure or you know, sort of this animosity of being a bully that is kind of going through the communication here, setting the tone that, we're not talking about serving and protecting. We're not talking about, community, my brother's keeper. We're not talking about this is how we're handling homeless people in D.C. We're saying if you talk back, then let's rough them up. So I definitely I think that there's I would call it a lack of leadership. I mean, he is a leader, obviously. He's a strong leader. Mm-hmm. But it's not that type of charisma can boomerang back critically and highlight a critical flaw in the approach to if you're going to roll out crime fighting a force multiplier when a real need exists. I don't think there are very many people that want to see people roughed up and thrown in vans and taken away to camps and stuff. I would say it's a very small percentage of people who think that's the best way we ought to run our country.
My last point on this is one of the points that I'm going to hold against Trump for the rest of my life is he made me like Gavin Newsom. I didn't like Gavin Newsom until the past few months, and he's standing up to this, so I've got to respect him. Well, unfortunately, we'll be talking about this. This brings us to Trump wants a peace prize. He's negotiated a couple of peace agreements, one in Africa that it's disputed by India and Pakistan as to whether he negotiated that. Maybe he's negotiated peace between Thailand and Cambodia. That remains to be seen. I don't know what he thinks he's done for Israel, Gaza. It's worse there than ever. He had a ceasefire in place negotiated by his predecessor. He tried to take credit for, and that all broke down. But he still wants to have his peace prize for negotiating the peace between Russia and Ukraine. And he was talking about this land swap. This great deal. Now, I assumed when he was talking about that he had already floated the idea with both Russia and Ukraine. Apparently, he hasn't because Ukraine is saying, no way, we're not giving it up. We're not going to trade. First of all, we don't even know what you're talking about. I mean, what, we get to keep Kursk that we're occupying? It doesn't even make sense. But no, we're not giving up our sovereign land. So apparently there hadn't been any conversation about that. And they still seem to think they have the upper hand with Zelensky. I mean, Zelensky, I mean, when he said you have no cards, and then, a couple weeks later, Zelensky blows up like a quarter of Russia's Air Force using drones, which has everybody concerned because that could actually happen here to our Air Force. But that's a whole other story. It's all of a sudden advanced militaries are feeling vulnerable to that. So we've got these talks. Zelensky wants to take part. He wants to be invited to this land that that the United States bought from Russia that some elements in the Russian government want back, by the way, Alaska. Will he give it back? But they're meeting on Friday, and Putin is going to be there. Now, Bernie Sanders said, hey, maybe Trump can make a difference here. But he clearly didn't clear anything through Zelensky. So what does he have in mind for this land swap? Dave, what's going on?
So this is one of those sort of rabbit holes I went down recently. And I think at the highest level, it's important to realize that depending where you are in the world and what your media diet is, you will be seeing and hearing very different information. And so in our country, I would say a significant portion of us align with the underdog, which is Ukraine, who was invaded territorially by, you know, the former empire of the Soviet Union, which is now Russia. But it's been a stalemate for a very long time. And so there are novel techniques and tools that have been used, but really this has become like a drone war kind of standoff. Unfortunately, you know, we've heard that there were up to 1 million casualties, but, you know, I did a little bit of digging and, you know, some of these leaked sources out there that are public and not classified, they're public, but they're leaks. US and British estimates provided on background estimate 2 million casualties. Wow. So it's really, it's hurting both countries to the core. Russia is just much bigger. And has a lot, Putin has a willingness to make vast sacrifices on behalf of his people.
You mean he's lost more than 1 million soldiers?
Casualties meaning death and disability.
I see. Okay. All right.
Yeah. So the public number is 1 million. Yeah.
I see.
It's really been trickling off as of late, but that's because the nature of the war has changed because of this standoff. But you know, this meeting on Friday, to kind of dive in, was requested by U.S. Envoy Steve Witkoff on behalf of President Trump. You've seen him speak in public, right? Trump has said, too much loss of life, this has to end, something's got to give. We see the indiscriminate bombings of civilians in Kyiv and other cities all over Ukraine. Energy, massive suffering, really civilian death, damage, suffering. It's incredibly expensive what they've been doing. Thousands and thousands of shells and missiles and drones and, you know, literally billions of dollars. I think it's like $50 billion a year for the duration so far. That's just the Ukraine side paid for by the United States and Europe. So it's been a mobilization of the defense industry globally. But there's a massive threat of both military and economic escalation. If there's secondary tariffs against Russian oil were charged to our allies, like trade partners, India and China, the intention would be to hurt Russia, but in reality, the ripples would be catastrophic. So that's the threat. Trump, the United States has, our security services have said, both nations consider threats to their security from each other to be existential. So both countries know, both Ukraine and Russia know that everything is on the line. And everybody also knows that Ukraine really doesn't have, like Trump said, they don't, no matter how much the United States gives them, no matter how much Europe gives them, in a head-to-head fight, Russia can always kind of take the upper hand and escalate to the extreme and hurt the whole Western world catastrophically. But Russia also doesn't want to lose any more influence than they already have in the post-Soviet states. There's like 15 post-Soviet states, and, you know, the Baltic states have already become part of NATO. And so Russia sees this slipping. And so there are some incentives for them to kind of come to the table here, even though it doesn't seem like it on the surface.
Their economy is also starting to really have some issues.
Interest rates there, 18%, hit hard by the cost of the war. The military budget is immense. Their country is just limping along. As long as he can continue to sell government bonds to Russian banks, he could keep things status quo. Putin doesn't have a demand side that's pressing too hard. He needs to exit with honor, so to speak. And so really, what got Trump and Putin together was Witkoff said, "You need the oil money, and we control the oil market." So to a certain extent, that's got him to the table. And so realistically, Putin and his government want more than just a big chunk of Ukraine. So we talked about the land swaps thing. It's really the swap, I think, is just Trump trying to say, you get a little, we get a little. But in reality, Ukraine looks like they'll be forced to give up a lot.
Yeah.
Also, Russia wants to keep Ukraine demilitarized and out of Western hands, out of NATO. So from our perspective, from the United States perspective, it seems like a non-starter. That's like, well, that would be fully giving over. If Ukraine's going to be neutral and Ukraine's going to give up land, well, what did we get in return? And I think that like the sort of the elephant in the room is peace. If we can guarantee peace, that's there may very well be, that may be enough. I'll say one more thing and then I'll hand it over to you.
Sure.
Putin also wants Zelensky gone out of office.
Right.
And, Seymour Hersh, who's got connections inside the Pentagon, he's been very accurate over the last few years with information that's been coming out. For example, he said 2 days before the bombing of Iran that the decision was made and that we were going to bomb Iran on like Saturday. Like he knew days ahead of time. So he's got good sources. And what he said is that the United States has already agreed Zelensky's gone. The question is when, because that's a necessary condition. For peace. The Ukrainian general Valtari Zaluzhny, sorry if I can't pronounce it properly, he's the commander-in-chief of the country's, was the commander-in-chief of the country's armed forces. He gave an interview that said, look, this is a stalemate. And he's in close contact with his adversary in the Russian armed forces. So there is already an identified candidate. And realistically, he is a credible successor. And the truth is that that would give Putin a way out. He can still say that he won if he's able to have Zelensky be gone, no more attacks on Russian territory. So what I think, it's a very long way of saying what I we could go into the details more. But what I think the end game here is the ceasefire terms are going to end up being an end of air warfare. So drones, missiles, bombs. No more attacking of energy infrastructure, airport traffic, and that this is beneficial enough to both sides to talk about a ceasefire. And then they could have a larger conference with new leadership that Putin's willing to talk to for a longer term peace treaty. So I think that's the best case scenario. And you had said, like, is Trump wants a Nobel Peace Prize? I don't think he's going to get a Nobel Peace Prize, but at the very least, this is an important first step towards that peace process.
You've got several things in there that I again, you're right. I'm just reading it from the American press and the European press, but you got several non-starters in there. For one thing, Zelensky is not going to willingly leave office until the war is over. I just don't see it. Is there going to be a coup against him? That will be destabilizing.
It's already underway. Yeah.
Then that's going to lead to a civil war in Ukraine.
He's not that popular right now with the people who like the shift. Excuse me. The shift from how many people wanted war at all costs versus how many people just want a ceasefire. That's been moving. That's been shifting.
Well, I agree with you.
That'll
be very interesting to see because, yeah, that would be a complete surrender by Ukraine and it would not lead to long-term peace. Russia, the next time it decides it wants more, would simply invade again because they will have been rewarded. That would not be the end of it. That would be like basically the Anschluss and then Czechoslovakia in circa 1938. So if that's what Trump is negotiating, it's not going to lead to long-term peace and it's a surrender. That's, so we'll see what happens. But it's, well, anyway, we're at the end of our time here, but that is very distressing if that's what's going to happen. And that would be a complete surrender to Russia. 100%. There's nothing for Ukraine there at all. Zero. But we'll see if that happens. I thought he had some clever idea about a land swap, and that appears to be just nothing. But that's where we're at. That brings us to predictions. What do you have, Dave?
Well, just following up on that last segment, I'm going to take the leap of, out of the box thinking here, which is that that the one thing that could lead to Putin stopping his aggression would be if he could get a claim that there's neutrality for Ukraine for a period of time, and that peace is guaranteed by Europe and the United States, but not NATO for an extended period of time. So I'm going to go for a twofer. I'm going to say that sometime before the end of the year, there's a change of leadership in Ukraine, and that this meeting between Putin and Trump on Friday leads to nothing substantive, but behind the scenes, it's going to unleash the potential for a longer lasting peace.
It'll be interesting to see what happens when the European leadership catches up with your analysis there.
Yeah.
Well, I'm going to predict that the BLS, of course, replacement looks to be Heritage Foundation economist E.G. Antoni, who is already being interviewed on Fox News and pretty much admitting that he can't do any better than his predecessor when it comes to the jobs numbers, because since the pandemic, businesses are having a hard time getting their survey results in time. So you've got the initial jobs report every month and a big difference by the time they all come in within the next couple of months. So he is already proposing that they just simply do quarterly reports rather than monthly reports. This is leading to a big backlash of investors, and everybody says we need those monthly reports and we need them to be accurate. But he's already admitting there's no way we can make them accurate. They can't force companies to get these surveys in. So pretty much, and pretty much the predecessor was fired, not because the information was late, but because it was bad for Trump, because it shows that his economy is failing. My prediction, therefore, is that he's probably not going to last very long because he can't make any changes. And they are, and we're probably going to go through a series of BLS chairs. We'll find out if any of those things come true. Until next time, stay informed and stay engaged.